Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. This week, we count the change and unearth a few treasures in an industry not so synonymous with design, that of money.
Using money as a guide, you can actually talk about the history of the world because it is so central and so all-pervasive in all societies for thousands of years.
We speak to Oslo-based studio Snurrhetta about their daring new redesign of the Norwegian banknote, which will likely pay dividends for the Nordic nation. Then our Belgrade correspondent brings us a report on how money talks to the politics of the Balkans.
Plus, a historian tells us about what a coin's design can teach us about humans, history and politics. And we finish off with a consideration of another mass-produced platform for national design, postage stamps.
All that to come right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Money is an unquestionably coveted commodity, but in our daily professional pursuit of wealth, we don't always stop to consider its physical form, what it's made of, and what the images and scribbles that adorn it actually mean. The chance to design a country's currency doesn't come around all that often, and when it does, it provides the opportunity to impact on a nation's image, both to visitors and to the citizens themselves.
One firm who has recently undertaken the task is Oslo-based Snurrhetta, who won a competition held by the Norwegian Central Bank to redesign that country's banknotes. I spoke to Martin Gran, the Managing Director of Brand Design at Snurrhetta, about the project.
The Central Bank of Norway had a competition inviting international and national firms to be pre-qualified into the competition. And the bank chose 8 different design agencies to submit different proposals. And we competed and won at the end. It was actually quite an interesting process because the jury decided that there was another winner than us and this other agency called the Metric Design System that got to actually design the banknotes. So it's a quite long process.
So maybe you can describe for me what your proposal looked like and how similar the project that you're now executing is to that original proposal.
Well, to try to describe how it looks like is a little hard, of course, and I'm not sure I'm paying enough respect to the actual design. But we did design upon a concept that the central bank decided before the competition, which was the sea. And the sea has been an important part of the Norwegian economic growth and our long, long heritage of especially fishing and in modern times finding other resources like oil. And we decided to interpret the concept of the sea into a concept that we call the beauty of boundaries. And the beauty of boundaries is best explained about that it's very interesting and sometimes very beautiful when different aspects meet. So taking out the sea that is meeting the ocean or where land goes over onto the ocean, it's where we find interesting things in life. And we try to design this concept, materializing a hard and a soft design together. So we designed a very systematic and rational pattern in terms of pixels, together with a very soft, wavish pattern on top of that, to have that as an interpretation of where differences meet. And we tried to connect some aspects from history together with today's pixelated visual context. So images are pixels and you have a lot of graphic design that is pixelated. And we try to connect those two things, that we have a bond to the history and a view into the future, combining the different motifs that the bank has decided from before. So this was kind of a modern interpretation of today's visual environment, so to say, and connected back to a more of an art history that we all know in the world. We decided to make one of the sides of the banknotes with pictures, with actually photographs in black and white, telling the same story that we created into the pixels. But as you probably know, it's now evolved into illustrations by the metric system. So the back and the forth side, if you can call the back and the forth side of a money bill, is also very different in its expression. And that's also something that nurtures into this concept of the beauty of the boundaries.
Martin, I wonder, how did the particular qualities of a banknote as an object, and an object with a very specific function, affect how you approached this brief? Because it has a very particular set of dimensions. You have to, you know, account, I presume, for security features. I wonder if the Bank of Norway placed any colour or other restrictions on you. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, the bank wanted to put some frames that control the project. So there was, they want to have a continuity of the colors connected to the different bill amounts. So the 50s had to long live the green color that was that from before, and also the four other bills had to connect it to the color. But we were free to interpret the color into a more of an artistic view, so that it's a color scheme more than actually divided into these colors. And also all the eight different agencies that got the brief were also sent to a one-day seminar together with the bank to learn about all the possibilities and restrictions, and of course a lot of security dimensions that I obviously can't talk that much about, but we learned a lot of the security aspects of a money bill. The interesting part as designer is that this is a enormously large design project, but the canvas is very, very little. So it's a quite interesting challenge for our designers to sit and work on something that is at the same time large and small.
If I'm correct, Martin, you began designing the notes, or at least were awarded the project in 2014. The notes aren't expected to roll off the production line or at least be introduced to the economy until 2017. What has to happen in that period? Why such a long run-up?
Well, first of all, our design has to be interpreted into what we can call the money design branch. The central bank has their own designers, so they have to interpret in our sort of photoshopped and quite traditional way of designing into this very, very special form of design for money bills. And that interpretation process takes quite a long time. And our design was actually so complex that many of the print houses that are devoted into money design said that it was not possible. So then we have to work together with the designers of the central bank, together with the print houses, to actually get the right expression. And when the design has been prototyped in the first print session, it has to be tested enormously various aspects in the real world life. ATM machines has to be changed, and there's a lot of security measures. So it takes a very long time to actually exchange money bills in any society, actually.
That was Martin Gran speaking to Monocle's Henry Reece Sheridan. And Martin Gran is the Managing Director of Brand Design for the Oslo-based design firm Snøhetta.
The Western Balkans have had a fraught history over the past two decades. That's due in part to the dissolution of Yugoslavia starting in the early 1990s. Today, there are six nations here, or seven if you recognise Kosovo.
Three of those Balkan nations now use the euro, but the other four have their own currency, iconography and coin designs. And as you'd expect from a region with a history of ethnic conflict, the money still carries symbolic meaning that's beyond its monetary value.
Monocle's Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaunay met with historian Vladimir Dulovic to discuss the meaning behind the dinar and more.
Anyone who's lived in the countries which used to make up Yugoslavia has lived through plenty of confusion and changes over the past 25 years in terms of the design of everyday things, like flags. If you've lived in Serbia, for example, You've had three different flags. The banknotes have changed as well, not just for Serbia, but for all the different countries which once formed the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, or the Socialist Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, as was. And a person who's lived through all these changes, and what's more, knows a fair bit about them too, is Vladimir Dulovic, a historian and writer of the only English language guidebooks you can buy about Serbia. Vlada, in terms of currency design, has it been a hot topic over the years?
Well, in a way, it's interesting. Now we have, from all of the banknotes, we have a lot of bearded and mustached men. So there's a lot of emphasis on the personalities from 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. There's a decent amount of scientists, world-known scientists. So there is Nikola Tesla.
It has to be said, looks fantastic on the 100 dinar note,
exactly,
doesn't it?
Exactly.
It's this wonderfully louche pose that he's striking there, leaning forward, chin resting on his hands, and a very cheeky twinkle in his eye.
Yes, and there's only one woman, so this could be a major fault in the design of all of the banknotes. We have only one woman. And then again, what it says that there is a lot of emphasis on kind of, this is the golden age of Serbia, 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. It's also interesting that we have Nikola Tesla, who was a Serb, but he's from Croatia. And in that way, in normal aspects, it would be seen as a kind of transnational personality who's done a lot for Croatia and for Serbia and for Serbs and for United States and the whole of the world. But over here, it's either-or situation in which who grabs the historic personality first gets to keep him as well.
So you're setting claim to other countries' icons?
Yeah, well, it's in a way, that would be one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that these countries wanted to get rid of some of their icons from the previous era, and the Serbs have decided to keep them. You could say that as well. But it's an interesting thing that we have personalities from the region as well, which again reflects that not all of Serbs live in Serbia. They live in Bosnia and Herzegovina and in Montenegro and in Croatia and in Macedonia and in other neighboring countries as well.
So the current Serbian banknotes, very much personality-led and trying to build this idea that great people have come from Serbia. But you've lived through the socialist Yugoslavia times as well, Vlada. What was on the banknotes then?
Back then it was a totally different approach. Probably they thought that they could never reconcile all the six nations and three languages and three religions and so on and so on. So what they opted for was to have, originally it was only workers, hard working people, fishermen, steel mill workers and so on. Later on, from 1950s, they went to a more tame design, where they were people in national costumes. Then there was the famous miner, and then there was a lot of monuments from various famous sculptures and of socialist Yugoslavia. The big change came in 1980s, and this was a very interesting period. The inflation was on the rise, and the banknotes, new banknotes, were needed. So what it came back then, that they couldn't actually agree, the six socialist republics, the future, which are soon going to become independent states, couldn't really decide on who's going to be on these banknotes of theirs. So what the designers did is they actually put just totally anonymous people. It was actually one guy who was making sketches for all of the banknotes. He put his family, first his wife and then his kids and babies. So we had his family basically on the banknotes, just because they couldn't agree on anything else being on a banknote. So that was a big change. And then, starting from 1990s, all of the former republics, the new countries, opted for these great personalities and famous sites around the country, that kind of design.
And of course, one of the other great things about these 100 dinar Nikola Tesla notes is that you only need a couple of these for a very nice drink at a pavement cafe in Belgrade, Vlada. That's about £1.30 at current exchange rate, and I believe that is something we can drink to. Cheers. For Monocle in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
What is it about money that excites you, Josh? I'm speaking specifically about its design aspect here, rather than your rabid materialism.
Yeah, my ruthless pursuit of riches aside, I think the thing that got us chatting about this theme of money was my visit to Australia at the beginning of the year, and to hearing tell of how the Australians had, in 1988, manufactured their own type of money, which was made of a polymer, which meant that they could all go surfing in the sea and it not be destroyed. And it just struck me as being a design problem that is pretty poorly addressed by a lot of people. You know, money's made of paper, it has an intrinsic value, but that paper, you know, shreds and washes away and kind of doesn't work. And if you have a $1 bill next to a $5 bill, the difference in size between those two things actually makes it very hard for you to know what you're handling. So that was the kickoff point.
One thing that looking into this episode and researching it has really struck me is that despite, and perhaps because of the cash's ubiquity, it completely goes under the radar of, you know, your visual registering of the world around you. And that's remarkable for a few reasons. I suppose one of the main ones is that notes are, both for functional and aesthetic reasons, so design rich, and coins, in terms of, you know, the different features that are on there, they're functioning as vehicles of meaning, as well as just straightforward monetary value. And it's been a pleasure to see some of the remarkable examples of currency design while putting this show together.
It's interesting. I mean, it goes back in that we're not a show about Roman history, but if you think about Romans mass producing coins, the first time a woman goes on the coin is significant. The first time that a woman goes on a coin in her own lifetime is significant. And you can actually measure kind of human achievement, the achievements of civilization, and also the brutally oppressive nature of a lot of regimes, you know, even up to this day, and even up to Guy Delaunay's package about, you know, Yugoslavia and the troubles with delineating what it means to be a particular country and identifying with a particular currency. And I think we're seeing that in the UK here. While very few people are suggesting that we join the single currency, join the euro, you know, people are wondering about whether the whole European project is doomed because of the failure of the euro in countries like Greece. So I think it's something with interesting symbolic value, and I don't think it's something that's kind of going away until we go completely contactless, that is.
As we've discussed, it's a useful commodity for securing goods and services, but cash is also a potent vehicle for meaning.
Historically, it's united populations under a common set of symbols and, more often than not, asserted some message of power and control in doing so.
To learn more about the history of the humble coin, I paid a visit to the City Money Gallery at the British Museum and spoke to its curator, Ben Alsop.
I am the City Money Gallery curator at the British Museum, so I'm the curator of a gallery that charts over 4,500 years of monetary history.
And very briefly, what do you have on display here at the City Money Gallery?
Well, we have something like 1,500 objects that are charting the history of money. And we do this because using money as a guide, you can actually talk about the history of the world, because it is so central and so all-pervasive in all societies for thousands of years.
What can we learn about the history of the world, specifically from the design of coinage?
Well, you can track particular design elements, you could track particular aesthetics of a particular society. So, very interestingly, things like portraiture are very important. So you see in ancient civilizations the kind of move towards realistic portraiture and this desire to move away from figurative representations to actually try and encapsulate someone in the portraiture on the coinage. You get to learn about the movement of language, actually incredibly important. That so in England, in Britain, the first examples of writing are on coins. They are the first examples we have in this country of indigenous writing. So that's incredibly important, because before the invention of the printing press, in Europe specifically in the Renaissance period, coins are the best mass communicator we have. They can communicate over thousands of miles. They can be easily replicated in their design, so one can look like the other. And so that's incredibly important and a great way to transmit ideas, imagery, religious ideas, political thought and so on.
So they were very much used as vehicles of meaning as well as vehicles of value.
Of course, because if you look at your modern coinage today, there are layers of meaning on them. They have a value. They can be used as a tradable commodity, as a tradable currency, but also the images that are on them aren't chosen by fluke. You know, they're thought about in a very in-depth way. The wording used on them, the type of imagery, the associated kind of symbols that we use on our coinage. And it's because of this transportable element of them. They are easily transportable, of course. They are central to societies and have been for thousands of years. And so, therefore, that we as humans have and continue to take a lot of time in how we design them and what we're trying to achieve with those designs.
Could you give me an extremely potted history of the kind of big milestones in coin design development through the ages?
Right, okay, so the history of coinage is something like 2,500 years old. And it begins in, most pointedly, in northwestern Turkey in a kingdom called Lydia. Now, they're the first place that issue coinage, which begins to, like, starts off the Western examples of coinage. But interestingly, at the same time, you also have coinage being designed in China, but to a very different style and design. So in Lydia, you have a two-sided piece of metal. It's of official weight. It's made of electrum, which is an amalgam of gold and silver. And looks, to a modern eye, you know, you could see it as a coin, whereas in China they have them in the shape of spades and latterly in the shape of knives. They are still coins, they fulfill the same functions, but they just look, to a modern eye, slightly different. So they're miniature tools, essentially.
And could you maybe pick out, let's say, two or three of the most interesting examples, to your mind, of coins in this gallery, and just maybe we can have a look at them? You can tell me about them?
Yeah,
great.
Sure.
Okay, what's his first one?
Right, okay, so what we're looking at here is a case of small coins that are about the size of about a 5 pence piece, maybe a 10 pence piece. And what they have is a design. So in this one, we see a head of a lion. This is the earliest examples of Lydian coinage, which are some of the earliest examples of coins in the world. And on it, you have a design of a tiger, of a lion. We think this because it... we say Lydia because this is a very well-known symbol from the kingdom of Lydia, but it gives you an idea of a central power. So having a uniform design on your coinage gives people an element of kind of a trust in their coinage, so they know there is a central power that backs it up, that it has come from a central authority, so the weight is good, the quality of the metal is good, because obviously in the ancient period we're dealing with money that has an intrinsic value, so it's worth the metal it is made of. Today we have more of a token coinage, so for instance it costs more to make a 2p than it's actually worth, if you see what I mean. So there are those elements. And this is the kind of the beginnings of our coinage system. So it has two sides. It has a design on one side and a design on the other, a more rude kind of punch mark, so two squares. But we are seeing the very beginnings of the coinage that we use today. So this is a huge moment in human history.
Great. Let's move on to the second one. How
right,
far are we moving?
So we're just down here.
Great.
What we're looking at now are a set of six coins that were minted for the Emperor Nero, the Roman Emperor Nero, in the first century AD. But what we're looking at here is the kind of zenith of realistic portraiture. What we are looking at are six coins that chart Nero from his adolescence to his eventual demise at the age of 29. And we see a man who grows considerably in size. But it's interesting that the realistic portraiture is so acutely observed. So you see him growing, his chin gets bigger and his cheeks get fatter as he gets older and as he kind of consumes more. And that's obviously a very conscious choice. These are gold coinages. These are the finest coins that would have been issued at the time. And you can see a king who wants to represent to his people, an emperor, pardon me, wants to represent to his people that he has changed. His physicality, the very look of himself has changed. And we take realistic portraiture for granted. So when you look at our modern coinage, you expect it to look something like the ruler, in our case, the queen in the UK. But this isn't always so. So it's particularly interesting to see a moment in time where this realistic portraiture is embraced and you see the real skill of the artist and the craftsman.
What's his third and final coin?
Okay, so we're looking now at the Spanish real, the 8 real, so this piece of 8, as it's become known in kind of folklore and piratical tales and so on. But what actually is most important about this coin is it is the first global currency, really. So the global currency today, which is the dollar, the origins of global currency find itself in the 16th and 15th centuries when Spain has a burgeoning empire, partly due to its access to silver. In Bolivia, has huge access to silver mines in South America. So it creates a coinage which actually finds itself being traded in four corners of the earth, really, along maritime paths, touching every habitable continent. And therefore, what we're looking at is a coin that travels beyond the Spanish Empire, just to various parts throughout the world, because of its desirability, because it's good quality silver, and it becomes a global currency and kind of the blueprint for global currencies that have come after.
That was Ben Allsop being treated to the Henry Rees Sheridan Experience. Ben Allsop is the curator of the City Money Gallery at the British Museum.
Regular listeners and Monocle readers may have detected our proclivity for the plushly published delights from UK-based Unit Editions. They've just put out a new book, Graphic Stamps, which shows what they can do at their finest.
Graphic designers and philatelists alike will fawn over the boldness of these sticky-backed beauties. The enduring qualities of these most disposable mediums is what's striking. The title is the first in the publisher's forthcoming archive series, a collection worth saving room for in any design library.
I spoke to one of the book's editors, Adrian Shaughnessy, to find out more.
We've started a new series within our publishing imprint called the Archive Series. And a lot of the books we're publishing are historical, design history. We have a lot of design historical books. And a lot of our work is done with archives. So we thought, let's put together a series of books that champion and glorify and, you know, get the value out of archives. And we found two guys who are hardcore graphic design stamp collectors. They collect stamps, but they only collect stamps from the graphic design perspective. And they've both amassed fantastic collections. They're both very knowledgeable, Blair Thompson and Ian Follett. They also have huge Instagram followings because they post their stamps on Instagram. And we just approached them and said, hey, let's do a book. And they said, good idea, let's do a book. And that's how it happened.
What are the particular design challenges and opportunities presented by a stamp?
The first thing that kind of screams out is size, because these are miniature things. These are tiny things. One of the leading British stamp designers is a wonderful man called David Gentleman, very well-known graphic designer and illustrator, I would say. And he has, since the 60s, I think he's now in his 90s, in the 60s, he designed, and it continued to do after that, but he designed some of the great British stamps, the Concord stamp and some other really seminal stamps. And he has some interesting things to say about that. He says that, in fact, we get the best out of graphic designers when we give them lots of restraints. If you give graphic designers total freedom, you tend to get a kind of mess. But if you restrict them, and one of the huge restrictions is size, so it forces, in Gentleman's opinion, and I totally agree with him, it forces graphic designers to be super inventive and make use of this tiny canvas and the technological aspects of stamp printing. So, in fact, it's a kind of, the restrictions are also, if you like, the stimulus for innovation.
Adrian, you've brought a copy of the book in with you. It's an absolutely beautiful tome. It's organised, I can see, from my perspective, by country. And you've got these kind of airport-style contractions of the different countries at the top of the page, GB for Great Britain, HK, I think I can see too, that must be Hong Kong. You're going to talk about some of your favourite stamps in the book. Where should we begin?
Well, we might as well begin with David Gentleman, an absolutely wonderful British designer. And in the 60s, he was the sort of, he kind of pioneered in British design imaginative stamps. Up until then, it had been the Queen's head. It had nothing to, or kind of heraldic things. Gentleman pulled stamp design into the modern age, and he has a modernist aesthetic. And I'm looking at two here, Concord. And the shape of Concord is so graphic, it just lends itself to the rectangular format of the stamps. And here's some others. Tony Benn, Anthony Wedgwood Benn, as he was in the 60s, was actually a great advocate of stamp design, a great advocate of design in general. And he commissioned Gentleman to do a wonderful series based around the new technology of communication, the telecommunications stamp. So just on this spread, we've got Concord and the new telecommunications world. He's rendered them very powerfully in modernist graphic terms.
Moving on, where are we going to look next?
Okay, I think now I'd like just to talk about, very briefly, Venezuela. There was a wonderful designer working in the 70s in Venezuela called Gerd Lefhart. His stamp designs are absolutely wonderful. They're graphic, they're concise, they have beautiful colours. They're remarkable. The typography is, they look like modern record covers for electronic music. They've got that sharpness, brilliant colour. And I think they are just remarkable examples of how a nation that has no, as far as I know, as far as I'm aware, has no tradition of graphic design, and yet somehow they're producing stamps that have this kind of really crisp, modernist aesthetic that is wonderfully timeless and actually incredibly contemporary.
That was Adrian Shaughnessy, a graphic designer and one of the editors of Graphic Stamps, a book which is available now from Unit Editions. And it's with regret that we have no more time left. My very special thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell, our sound engineer, Claire Urban, and the show's producer, sat right opposite me, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, it's Henry Rhys Sheridan.
If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a note. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next week at the same time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And do leave us a review on the latter if you're a fan of the show. Thanks for listening. Until next week, it's goodbye from me, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And goodbye from me, Josh Fenner. Thanks for tuning in.